Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
This show is a proud member of the On Us All Podcast Network.
Is Tony Stark the greatest hero or villain of the MCU? We are talking about all this and more in the latest episode of Doomsday Prep. This is a series we created in light of Avengers Doomsday coming out at the end of this year. As such, we are doing a complete rewatch of the MCU and the Fox X-Men movies. So you can check out the previous episode for the first Fox X-Men trilogy. Now we are getting into the next set, the beginning of the MCU. I am very excited for this. I am one of your geekologists here at Systematic Geekology. We are the priest of the geeks. I am Kevin Schaefer. And Christian Ashley, one of my favorite geekologists and also MCU enthusiasts. Christian, how are you today?
Doing well, Kevin. It's a fun day.
That's great. I know you just had a vacation. I'm off the rest of this week, and it's so nice here, and I'm just looking forward to getting outside after being like in hibernation mode all of winter. So I'm very excited for that. But yeah, I'm really excited for this episode. So before we get started, if you are new here or if you are a longtime viewer listener of Systematic Geekology, hey, thank you so much for being here. Please like, rate, review, subscribe. It really helps us out wherever, whether you're watching this on YouTube or listening on any of our podcast platforms at a later time. We really appreciate your support. And if you would like to find out how you can support the show, just click on the link in the description. That'll take you to everything you need there. I also want to thank one of our supporters, Annette Knoll. Annette, thank you so much. And if you become one of our supporters, you will get a shout out on the show. So we really appreciate it. Well, Christian, just really quick before we get into the main topics, what have you been geeking out on lately?
Yeah, I finished my second re-listen to the Creepcast podcast. That is a podcast made by YouTubers Wendigoon, and I believe it's Meat Kenyon, Papa Meat. I'm not as familiar with him as I am with Wendigoon. And they go through different creepypastas and short stories and the like, horror, and read them and add their own entertaining dialogue and how they feel about the story, whether it's really bad, whether it's really good. It's a really fun time.
Very cool. I will have to check that out. Yeah, for me, I did, as if I needed another service, but I did subscribe to DC Infinite Universe or whatever they call it, the DC Comics app that has, you know, a massive library. I really like it, too, because I read primarily digitally these days just for accessibility. And I mean, with not only the library they have on there, but like you can get books in trades, you can. It's really easy access, so I'm really enjoying that. I'm using it to catch up on all of the Absolute stuff right now, and then going through some older comics as well, but really enjoying that. So it's well worth checking out. It's very reasonably priced, I would say, for the amount of content on there. So yeah, really enjoying that, but awesome. All right, well, let us get into it. So for this episode, again, we are going to be talking about the first Iron Man movie, which kickstarted the MCU, The Incredible Hulk, and then Iron Man 2. So let's get in first to Iron Man. Now, Christian, I'm really interested here because on the X-Men episode, I would say all three of us, you, me, and Andy, had background with the X-Men when the movie came out, whether it was through the cartoons or the comics. I'm curious, when Iron Man came out in 2008, The MCU wasn't even a concept, really. We didn't know that they were planning a shared cinematic universe. We were just heard about this one individual movie. And I had I had heard of the character. I had seen him in some of the animation in the 90s. He actually had his own show, but I may have seen just a few episodes of that. It wasn't nearly as good as like Spider-Man and X-Men. But he was pretty much like a very B, even C-list character at the time. What was your background with the character when this movie came out?
Yeah, at best in the world, he was a B-lister at that time. And in comics, he was a little more, but like overall, I'd put him there. But my introduction was the animated series. Ran on for 2 seasons. It really adapted more of like the Force Works comics, but a lot of more of the Iron Man stories along the way. So that was my introduction to him there. Of course, he showed up in Spider-Man, and then eventually the Secret Wars episode that they did there too. I'm pretty sure he showed up in the Avengers United Stand cartoon in the late 90s, early 2000s in one episode, because they focus more, probably for licensing reasons, on the other lesser known, especially then at the time, Avengers. Then after that, you know, I actually started reading my dad's comics. So I went through, you know, every appearance he did in Marvel Team Up. I started reading the Avengers. I read a couple of his solo issues. So I knew him fairly well by the time the movie came out.
That's interesting. Yeah, because like, I mean, yeah, I had seen him in stuff. And then I'm trying to remember the timeline of when, if you remember, there was like the Ultimate Avengers animated movie, but I can't remember if that came. Do you remember if that came out closer to the time of Avengers, or we can look it up? But like, I just thought of that.
It was before.
Yeah, I mean, I know it was, but I think it was definitely before Avengers, but I can't remember if it was. Oh, so it was. Okay, so then I had seen that, and that was quite good. Because it was actually kind of rare for Marvel to do animated movies like DC had done. And so I remember that one really well. So I had to, I mean, but yeah, it was really those like that were my, you know, prime knowledge of the character. So I went in, you know, I mean, I knew the, you know, some of the basics, but I will never forget. One of my best friends in middle school and I were hanging out at the mall and, he showed me the first image they released of Iron Man months before the movie came out. And it just looked stunning. I mean, it was the Stan Winston design. It was like, just from that image, you had a feeling that this was going to be something special. The movie, you know, very much blew me away. I mean, this was the same summer as Dark Knight. It was a really game changing time for comic book movies. And this one in particular really just took the world by storm. So what was it? Well, you know, coming out of this movie the first time, would you have been, because I was in middle school, were you in high school at the time?
I was 18.
Yeah.
That's my senior year. And I remember being very pleased with what I saw. I think I even told my dad, like, oh, this feels like a perfect movie to me. Now, in hindsight, I could say it's not, but you know, it's really good. It got what it needed to get done. And you know, I enjoyed seeing him on screen. Got the little teas we got of War Machine possibly showing up later on too. And of course, we'll get to the end credits in a bit since you have that for later on. But like, I was like, okay, I'm ready for more.
100%. It was just, I mean, there was so much about, I mean, it's not perfect, but it still holds up all these years as just like, I mean, a great, you know, a individual story. It just has all the momentum is there. The performance, of course, this was, I mean, one of the best castings, not just in comic book movies, but as far as just fictional characters brought to life. Yeah. Robert Downey Jr. was, and is Tony Stark. And we will also, we can start talking in this episode about the Doomsday connections, because I, you know, I definitely want to get into, I've been consuming all the theories about, you know, why the, RDJ has to play Doom, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But yeah, it was just, it blew me away the first time. There was the grounded aspect of it. It wasn't this like silly, over the top. Not that I don't like silly over the top comic book movies, but this was a very different one. And like I said, it came out the same summer as Dark Knight. This was like right at the beginning of the summer going into it. And then Dark Knight was a few months later. Both were game changers. And it's like, you know, at this point we had the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy. We'd had the Fox X-Men trilogy. You know, decades before Batman 89 and Superman 78. So there was that, but it was not this mass influx of comic book movies like there are today. And so this one was a big game changer in terms of the scale, the scope, but at its core, it is a character-driven story about a guy who is there, like, the complete opposite of the characters we had seen before of, you know, characters like Peter Parker and the mutants who we are very drawn to because they're relatable, they're one of us, they're kind of, you know, anyone who feels like a bit of an outcast or nerdy or anything like that, like, you're drawn to these characters. This guy, Tony Stark, is a egotistical billionaire. He is the guy, and especially, you know, at this time in, you know, our culture, in 2008, you know, this was everything everyone hated. This, like, you know, war profiteering, egomaniac who only cares about himself and advancing technologies and is so sure about himself that he's not willing to listen to dissenting opinions. And then, of course, he goes through this origin story of being captured by terrorists, learning that the weapons he built are being used to kill the people that he intended to protect, and everything he thought he knew is not what it is. And he now has to reconcile with who he is as a person, what is his moral framework. It asks so many great questions in this film, and a lot of those, you know, carry through the rest of the MCU and the rest of Tony's arc. So I love how much is set up here. And like you said, too, all of the Easter eggs are planted. We didn't know that this was the foundation for a cinematic universe, but it started to plant the seeds of, okay, you know, Rhodey teases becoming War Machine. And then, of course, we'll get into the post-credit scene. But there's this, like, you know, it just feels like a, within one movie, it feels just like an established universe, an intricate world. And you have this very grounded character and a more grounded story. I mean, obviously, he's running around a robot suit, but still, it's more, it's not your typical, oh, he got, you know, bitten by a radioactive spider, or transformed into a Hulk. Is, you know, he's, you know, it doesn't have superpowers. And yeah, this was just, it. And I remember, too, like, my brother, for instance, is not really a comic book fan, and I remember him enjoying this one and him enjoying Iron Man 2 a lot, you know, like, some of those earlier ones. It had this mass cultural impact that we weren't as accustomed to seeing. You know, like I said, the Spider-Man trilogy had that, but it was pretty rare for something of this scale, and especially a more B-level character to, you know, present as, you know, to be appealing to mainstream audiences, and really plant the seeds for something bigger.
Oh, you guys, I really hate to interrupt, but my name's TJ, and I'm here to tell you about our new merch. We have incredible new stuff with Fourth Wall. We have just partnered with them as a new store. They have a lot more to offer, which means we have a lot more to offer. We can now offer you beautiful Comfort Colors t-shirts. They're so comfy. I wear mine all the time. And we've got it all now. Cups, hats, backpacks, pajamas. If you want your Systematic Geekology pajamas, you know where to go. My personal favorite is actually our Throne of Geeks shirt. It is Comfort Colors, you know, blue, black, green, red, orange. And the shirts are just so nice. And the shirt itself, we've got the Throne of Iron geeked out. Because, you know, that's our brand. We've got Mjolnir on there, the Buster Sword, Trident. Basically just the coolest weapons from our favorite properties are on the shirt instead of a bunch of normal boring swords from the boring series Game of Thrones. So check that out, and thank you.
So yeah, this one is, you know, it remains one of my favorites. I mean, now I don't want to just gush praise of it, but what, you know, we looking at it retrospectively, what, Christian, what are some just highs and lows for you of the movie?
I'll say high as far as like adapting his origin, because unlike Batman, unlike Spider-Man, you need to see his origin because it hasn't been told a million times before to a general audience. Now, I knew the origin because I'd read the comics. But, you know, to everyone else who doesn't know anything about the comics, they can say, oh, I need... Well, originally, in the canon, it was the Vietnam War. Well, we're not dealing with that anymore. We are in Afghanistan at the time. So it is natural for him to be going there in his job as a businessman to showcase, hey, this is the big bad stuff. We're going to be raining down upon our enemies. Like, I'm your guy. I'm really cool. I'm suave. And that being brought to a point of humility, and then, you know, the changing of his origin at that point still works really well because they keep the Middle Eastern conflict in there, but then they go with the Ten Rings thing without the Mandarin, the real Mandarin, which I to this day think is a misstep, and I understand why. They don't want to be accused of being racist. Well, you know how you're not accused of being racist? Well, if you write a character well. You write the Mandarin well, you can have him as his number one enemy, which is what we were robbed of. And you know what they do with the character that's based in lore, in canon, on, you know, the Mandarin, what they do with Shang-Chi's father, spoiler, sorry, along the way. You know, that's interesting in its own right, but he's not the Mandarin. I want the Ten Rings, the actual rings, and the powerful, you know, menace that he has. So that's a gripe I still have to this day about it. Once again, I understand why, but I think there's stupid reasons if you could just, you know, write well. But whatever. His relationship with Pepper Potts is great here. Rhodey as well. Him being, because like you mentioned earlier, he's someone you typically wouldn't want to identify with. And that's why Stan Lee made him in the first place forever ago. During the midst of the Vietnam War happening on its way beforehand, he was like, can I make a character? Because he was created before we actually got involved. Can I make a character like these people that the readers I have don't want to like and make them like him? And I would say he succeeded beyond his wildest imagination, especially with the movie coming out, because he's haughty. He's extremely, extremely prideful, always thinks that he's right, never listens to anyone else. And yet, when he starts to develop a bit of a heart, and they make the joke about it in the film, like he is better. He doesn't completely learn his lesson, but it gets to the point where he is not as bad as he would have been, because he's still Tony. He's still prideful. He still thinks he's the smartest person in the room, but he's also willing to listen a little more after the events of this film.
And just to add on that, so I mean, again, I do want to start talking about Doomsday and all the implications and looking at each, you know, movie in the series. And, you know, because I mean, Doomsday is going to be the culmination of years of storytelling, just like Endgame was. And I have been following all of the theories, because when they first announced that RDJ was going to play Doom, I was like, that is so desperate. This is dumb. Uh-huh. I hate it. And you know, would I have made that decision if I was Feige or an executive? No, I would have gone for a different version to do. But now, after letting it settle and then consuming every theory imaginable, like because I watch Screen Crush and New Rock Stars and all those, you know, YouTube channels that overanalyze these things. And, you know, one of the theories that I found are interesting, not only are there, you know, natural comparisons between Tony Stark and Victor Von Doom in terms of their ambition and their scale, and, you know, there are many comics that explore that, but yes, there's the adoption theory, which I find really interesting, that it basically said, because in Endgame, when Tony goes back in time and meets Howard Stark, and he asks him what day it is, because Howard talks about how his wife is expecting, and there's a confused look on his face, it indicating that the timeline doesn't match up with when he was born. So there's theories now that Tony, because, and I'm saying this because you said that about, like, you know, could he be as bad as the theory that's running around is that the Tony Stark we've known all these years was actually born Victor Von Doom, but was adopted because the the biological son of the Starks died either in childbirth, and they adopted Tony. Adopted, let's say, Victor and changed his name to Tony. Now, this is one of many theories, but at first I was like, that's a little bit of a stretch, but knowing how much multiversal shenanigans are going to take place in Doomsday and Secret Wars, I'm willing to give credit to that, to like, you know, we still don't know, of course, what they're going to do, but that's been on my mind as I'm doing this rewatch of looking at the seeds planted, particularly with Tony's journey and how is it going to connect to Doom. So that's one I found interesting. Again, it may be complete BS, I don't know, but I'm just, you know, because the Russo brothers specifically said no one else but RDJ could have played this version of Doom. So there's a definitive reason why, and it's not just like fan service. So, you know, I'm really curious once we get to December how it will all play out. You know, we may not even learn all of that until Secret Wars. I don't know. But anyway, that kind of time. But it ties back to looking at this movie. all of the different layers to Tony's character. And I like how, like you said, they, you know, they don't make him one note. They make him the one you don't like, but you're still drawn to. A lot of that, again, is RDJ's performance. But he goes through this really compelling arc. Another thing is, hey, so since you brought up the Mandarin and everything, I agree with many of that. I do, now granted, I do like that the twist that they did in Iron Man 3, while I wasn't a fan of it at the time, it ended up giving us Ben Kingsley's Trevor, which led to Wonder Man, and it is a phenomenal show. You must watch it if you have not. So I'll just say that. But going back to this movie, I really do love what they do with Obadiah Stane here, because, you know, they don't come out and announce him as the villain right away. Like, you know, if you're watching, it's Jeff Bridges playing him. He's probably not going to play a useless side character. You know, I mean, he has been running the company with Tony since Howard Stark died. Yes, it's likely that he would be the villain. Nonetheless, I like how they play out that relationship and the betrayal, and it has an impact, and, you know, and I think that I would say the fight at the end holds up pretty well. What I like too is that all of the narrative threads in this really connect. I mean, it doesn't just set something up and then throw it out. Like, for instance, the icing problem, it comes back to that in the final fight. I mean, there's build up, there's great storytelling. A lot of this is because of Jon Favreau. I mean, I think he was the perfect person to, you know, really shepherd this character, kickstart this universe. Obviously, he's been a staple of the MCU from the beginning and remains one, even though he hasn't directed an entry since Iron Man 2. He's obviously played Happy Hogan in Iron Man and Spider-Man and Avengers, and been an executive producer on multiple Avengers movies. So, I really do think the storytelling here holds up. Going back to this being 2008, set in Afghanistan, I would say the Middle Eastern villains are pretty much reduced to just terrorists. And, like, not that you want to make, you know, the bad guys anything but bad, but at the same time, this was like, and we'll see this a lot in comic book movies throughout this time, it's a lot of it is very 9/11 response, and there are going to be stereotypes here. And we get a great character in the form of Jensen, who plays a pivotal role in Tony from the beginning and is, I think, one of the most important characters in the MCU. He's great. But yeah, but there are still those very 9/11 era stereotypes and depictions that are going to be there.
I will say I have always hated the ending with him revealing his secret identity, because I'm more of a purist and I want my superheroes to have secret identities outside of letting them know each other. Like, after a while, like, it makes sense, like, in the current comics, why he's given his identity out to the world, especially with Civil War, you know, happening in that continuity. Would not make sense for them not to know who he is. He's not like, wasn't like the Fantastic Four. It's fairly obvious who they were, so they didn't have to have secret identities, but most other superheroes had them. And that's something they played with the rest of the MCU, is that no one really has a secret identity outside of Peter Parker, really. And then there will be other people along the way, but like main characters, everyone's just like, yeah, that's who I am. Let me take my mask off every film so everyone can know who I am. And because we have to see our actors' beautiful faces, I can't stand that.
That's fair. I mean, I still remember when that happened. I was like, whoa, they did that. And that was unheard of, because, like you said, I mean, like, superhero is just like, that's an integral part, is they have a secret identity. I do think if any character is going to do that, it's Tony. It's going to be one who is just through the reconciliation of he wants to make up for past mistakes. He wants to, and, you know, hiding in this regard wouldn't make sense. But also ego plays a part in too. He kind of wants to take credit for everything as well. But I do love especially the performance in that moment, because, you know, he has the script and he says, like, well, clearly I'm not the hero type. And then he's just like, screw it, I am Iron Man. It was a mic drop for the movie, but that's a fair point, you know. And speaking of endings, I know I would love to go on and on, but we do have two more movies to cover. But the post-credit scene, what was your reaction the first time you hear Sam Jackson, Nick Fury come out? I want to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative.
I had no clue whatsoever that was happening. I see Samuel L. Jackson with an eye patch on his head. He mentions the Avengers Initiative, and I lost my ever-loving mind. This isn't just standalone. They're actually going to connect stuff, is where my head went immediately. Could we get Captain America? Could we get, like, Giant Man or the Wasp or the Hulk, which is obviously next, but like, because I didn't know that movie was coming out. It's like, yes, I want to see these people on screen because I've read the Avengers comics. I want to, like, I want them to be real.
It was just, I mean, I think any even like remote comic fan or even ones who had just like mainly watched the cartoons, like this was just it. Whoa, they're actually going there. Cause I mean, like X-Men, of course, there's multiple characters, but it's X-Men. There's, you know, it's not like it's different kind. This is actual crossover. They're bringing together, you know, we had never seen Justice League. We had never seen, but you know, this was a massive deal. And especially, I mean, just the fact that they got Sam Jackson, because if anyone knows that the Ultimates version of Nick Fury in the comics was inspired by Samuel L. Jackson. But nonetheless, it's like someone as famous as that, they, you know, there was no guarantee that they could get him. But no one else could have played that role. And it was just, oh, ultimate mic drop. It's still going to go down as, now we're so accustomed to post-credit scenes, but at that time, this changed everything. Yes. So, yeah. Well, Christian, leading to that, let's talk about the next entry, and that is the 2008's The Incredible Hulk, which came out just a few months later. And just a brief background here. So, whereas Iron Man had never been done on the big screen before, there was the Ang Lee Hulk movie from a few years earlier, which is not part of the MCU, starred Eric Bana. But because of that, now this is what, like you were talking about earlier, like they needed to show Iron Man's origin. A lot of mainstream viewers did not know who that was. Hulk, on the other hand, had just had that movie a few years ago, even though it's disconnected. But even then, between the 80s television series and that movie, more people knew Hulk's origin than Iron Man. So they knew going in that they didn't want to completely revamp that. And that's actually one of my favorite parts of this movie, is they do the origin in a montage sequence in the titles. And I actually really like that. It gives you exactly what you need to know. Okay, Bruce Banner is a scientist, experimented with gamma radiation. It went wrong. He turned into the Hulk. His girlfriend's father is in the military, and it hunts him down, and now he's living off the grid. It's very simple, straightforward. I really like that. So, yeah, I'll give quick, you know, my kind of background of this movie. It's interesting because this is one that's typically, like, not only looked down upon, but often completely forgotten. And part of that is they, well, of course, Hulk has been, you know, part of the MCU for a long time and remains that. There's a few reasons here. I mean, this starred Edward Norton, not Mark Ruffalo. There's a whole story there about why, he did not return to play the character. You can look it up, but there's that. There's also, this is the only solo Hulk movie in the MCU, due to rights issues that I still don't understand. It's confusing. Like Hollywood has different studio ownership of characters, but they can still put him in a team-up movie, but on a solo movie, it's a little over my head. But anyway, that's why we've only gotten this one that was produced by Universal. But you know, so it is pretty forgotten up until, for whatever reason, they made Captain America: Brave New World a semi-sequel to The Incredible Hulk. That was a choice. But for the most part, we haven't really come back to this movie a lot. But I will say, even though this one is typically ranked toward the lower end of the MCU, I remember quite enjoying it at the time. I mean, I always really loved the Hulk. I loved Bruce Banner. That was one of my favorite action figures as a kid. I loved the 90s cartoon, some of the comics and whatnot. So I always gravitated toward the character. And doing a rewatch of this, I was actually pleasantly surprised. I mean, the CGI does not hold up great, but as far as the story and making a more tender-hearted superhero story in contrast to something like Iron Man, I think it still holds up actually quite a bit. It is, you know, very far from perfect by any means. And, but I thought on a rewatch, I was quite entertained, and I think it's a good introduction to the character in the MCU. I think Edward Norton did a great job. I like how it expands on the military themes here, and, you know, it captures the heart and soul of Hulk. Also a really good score. I don't know. Kristen, what do you think of this movie, though? Like, both what you thought of it maybe at the time and, you know, if you have thoughts on it retrospectively.
Yeah. This movie, to me, you used the word forgettable or thereabouts earlier on. That's exactly how I feel. It's just kind of like it exists. I know it exists. I think I remember things that happened in it, even after rewatching it fairly recently to prepare for this. But it's just, it's there to make the Hulk a character in people's minds. That's the best thing I can say about it, in my opinion, because it's not bad. I mean, it's way better than, you know, Ang Lee, Hulk just want daddy to love him film. But that doesn't, because it's better than that, doesn't make it good. I think the Abomination is wasted here. You get the lead up to the leader, and that's not paid off until Brave New World, which, why is he facing, you know, Captain America, Sam, because of licensing issues. That's why the whole Universal thing, how they can, they own the rights to his solo films, but not to when he's team up. That's legal BS I couldn't care less about, except for the fact that it doesn't give me what I want, which is, you know, actually just explore his character a little more on his own. But yeah, it is what it is. I mean, I'm grateful for it because it helps solidify the thought we had at the post-credits of Iron Man when we see the post-credits for this one with Tony Stark meeting with Thunderbolt Ross, you know, about everything going on there. It's like, okay, they're doing this for real. That's the really the thing I remember about this film. It's like, we're not joking about this. We're not just teasing you. No, this is going to happen.
Now, I will say on that, one of the things that was, like, I didn't think about for a long time, but I was, like, disappointed on a rewatch here is, I still remember that post-credit scene the first time of Tony coming to Ross. And that's something I really wish they had explored more in future Avengers movies is, okay, Tony is buddy-buddies with Ross, but also him and Bruce hit it off right away, right? Like, they're both scientists, yeah. They both have, and so I really wish they had explored that conflict of having, you know, Bruce's nemesis, who has literally tried to kill him, has, you know, has brought a rift between him and the love of his life, like, and hunted him across the world, you know, is a, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say, like, him and Tony are best friends or anything, but they are allies. They have this kinship and, you know, they're on the same side in Civil War. And I think it was a missed opportunity to not have Bruce be a part of Civil War. I realize it would have been hard to integrate in terms of, like, okay, whoever has the Hulk on their team, it puts them at an advantage. But nonetheless, like, exactly. But, like, at the same time, it's like, it just would have been something interesting to come back to explore that rift of, you know, because the, like, the dichotomy between Steve and Tony is set up very early on. But, you know, like I said, Tony and Bruce really have this connection and chemistry with each other. And I would have liked to see some conflict between them, you know, not in a forced way, but it's like they introduced, you know, an element here that they never really came back to. But yeah, I mean, it's just like, I know, and I totally see your points here. And for a while I kind of thought that, but again, I was just kind of pleasantly surprised on a rewatch. I'm like, you know, maybe it's just cause I do love this character. And I think this one, yes, it's very simple. It's forgettable in the sense of it being compared, especially to a lot of other MCU entries and other comic book movies, but I like how it approaches the character. I like it, how it pays homage to the 80s series. The Lou Ferrigno cameo is fantastic. Actually, my dad and I got to meet Lou Ferrigno at a signing about a year ago. That was really cool. But I like how it's like, it's simpler, it's a little pulpy. Yes, I agree, the villains could have been done much better. I mean, you got great casting with Tim Roth and Tim Blake Nelson, but I think they would have paid off more if they had continued them in sequels. But I agree, but what they did with Abomination, I won't say it was an abomination, haha. But it was underutilized. I think it would have been like he turns into the Abomination at the end and then is kind of a main villain in the sequel. But you know, of course, we never got a sequel here. But I think what I really liked though about the movie, again, beyond Far From Perfect, and you know, it's still ranked toward the lower end of the MCU. Granted, I think there are ones that are way worse. I'll get to, you know, we'll touch on those later in the series. But
yes,
I really do like the relationship between Bruce and Betty here. I think it's well cast. And I think that's really the heart and soul of the movie. So it kind of makes up for some of the lesser aspects of, like, I don't need it necessarily to focus on a traditional hero villain, because really Hulk is more about him trying to, control himself. And, you know, he hates having the Hulk in him, but I think Betty helps him see that, oh, he can use it as a force for good. He doesn't have to be a monster. And I like how it explores those themes. And it's, you know, there are some really good scenes. I really like the one in the cave after the big fight with the military, and him and Betty are on the run, and she has to calm him down again. I like the pacing there, like the setting. So there's like, yeah, I mean, again, not far beyond far from a perfect movie, but as someone who was going into it kind of like, okay, this is going to be more my homework for this series, it's been a minute since I've watched it, I enjoyed it. You know, it was a good Saturday afternoon watch. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm at with this one. But yeah, so I know where I get to the next. So,
Hey, podcast fam. Want to stay even more connected with the show? We've got you covered. Check us out on Instagram and Blue Sky, where we're posting exclusive content and bonus videos and fun updates that you won't get anywhere else. From sneak previews of upcoming episodes to bonus content, our social accounts are the best way to keep the conversation going. Plus, it's a great spot for you to interact with other listeners and share your thoughts. We love hearing from you. When you follow us, it helps us grow and continue bringing you the content that you love. Whether it's a funny poll, a quick clip from today's episodes, or just random thoughts, you'll feel more plugged into everything we're doing. So go ahead and hit that follow button on Instagram and Blue Sky. It's one more way to be a part of the show and keep the good vibes flowing. Thanks for being a part of the family, and we can't wait to see you there.
And yeah, real quick though, if we did, in a perfect world, get another solo Hulk movie, what would you, like, is there a storyline you would have want adapted?
Storyline specifically, no, but like more of an idea. When you brought this question to me a couple days ago, I was like, what would I do? I mean, I think I'd do what the Ang Lee film couldn't, and actually explore Bruce's psyche more, and probably have like the leader actually become the leader, capture the Hulk, and maybe you make him have to create the UFOs or Zazax or Zimnu or something like that to fight the Hulk, to get him incapacitated, to where he's got him in a moment, to where he's forced to look back at his past, and we could maybe get Joe Fixit, Savage Hulk, Devil Hulk on screen in his own mind fighting for control, and maybe one of them wins at the end of the film, and like that one beats the leader, and the cliffhanger is like, okay, which Hulk are we going to get after this? Are they going to be able to break out? Is Bruce ever going to be whole again? Something like that, just with like having a few days of prep for an idea to create a script here.
No, absolutely. I think it's a great idea. And like, I don't have it, and they like super fleshed out. I guess like I really enjoyed World War Hulk back in the day. Like, it's been a minute since I've read that, but I think that would have been a good storyline. But really, I mean, in an ideal world, we would have had some of the ideas from Brave New World in an actual Hulk movie. And if we had gotten to see a Hulk face off with Thunderbolt Ross as Red Hulk, I mean, that would have been great. You know, just building on those elements more, but you know, alas, you know, it is what it is.
We live where we do.
We do. Yeah. We move on. But, well, moving on to our, third and final movie of the night. So Iron Man 2, which came out in 2010. And you know, this is one that of course had a lot to live up to with how successful the first movie was. And this one starts to really emphasize the large world building of the MCU. Cause like we said, you know, there were big teases in, especially Iron Man and then in the Hulk, but this one, okay, bring in Natasha Romanoff. We, you know, we start setting up the Avengers more. The post credit scene features, Mjolnir. There's a lot going on here. That is, and this is, I think, actually, as much as I like those elements, it also speaks to one of the big flaws of the movie, because if you look up, you know, like, YouTube videos on this, like, Jon Favreau had a plan for a whole trilogy, but this was why, you know, where Marvel started to interfere and, you know, made him change course, because he wanted to make this one more character focused and actually deal with Tony's alcoholism, but he was kind of forced to, you know, hammer in Avengers elements and world building and stuff like that. And I mean, yes, we get Scarlett Johansson first appearance as Natasha Romanoff is great. But it also, some of the sideline stories kind of detract from the main narrative. And, you know, this is another one. It's perfectly entertaining for me, but I think I did really enjoy it at the time it came out, because this was still on the high. I mean, I think the reason this one does, you know, also fall toward the bottom or, like, you know, lesser, you know, group of MCU movies is because there are so many that are way better. But at the time, we only had like 3 movies in this series. And yeah, at that time, it was still really good. Looking at it now, yeah, I mean, for me, it's entertaining. It does have some great moments in it. But ultimately, those elements of it trying to juggle multiple things and world building without as much emphasis on, I think, clearly the story that Favreau wanted to tell, that is very apparent here. I don't know, Christian, what were your thoughts kind of maybe at the time and then looking at it now?
Yeah, this is one of those that in hindsight, I kind of go, wait, I was in the minority? I really love this film and everyone else isn't as big on it as me. And yeah, I can still look at it and see its flaws. And like, if, you know, Civil War and Winter Soldier and No Way Home didn't exist, this would probably be my number one MCU film. I mean, like no joke, because I enjoy it. We get a War Machine here. Yeah, recasting, blah, blah, blah. Whiplash isn't like the best villain in the world, but we got Justin Hammer. We got the Demon in the Bottle being portrayed here. I was kind of really hoping they would do some Armor War stuff, but I don't think there'd been enough to establish that, because, you know, was he going to do fight Stingray and a bunch of other people that just for the sake of this film? I highly doubt it. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I got to see a little more character study of Tony in how, like, the success has gotten to him. And, you know, like, what am I supposed to do now? I am a superhero. And of course, you get some great scenes with Nick Fury working with Tony here. It's like trying to get him back on track. Like, hey, I need you together because with bad things are happening around here. We need you at your best. But yeah, the final confrontation, I mean, yeah, is it a bunch of shooting and lasers and missiles and whatnot? Yeah, absolutely. But I love it. Is it a huge retcon that the kid in the Iron Man mask is supposed to be Peter Parker now? Absolutely it is. But you know what? It's fine. I'd still love it for what it is.
That's really interesting. I know. I mean, and like I said, I quite enjoy the time, and I still find it very entertaining. I definitely want to put it that high on my list, but that's really interesting. And well, it, you know, looking at this too, so it does have 2 of my favorite Tony moments: one funny and one really pertinent to his character. The funniest one that I still remember getting a kick out of when I first saw it is when he's at the donut shop or whatever with Nick Fury, and he's like hanging on the top of the build or top of the sign, and then it cuts to them inside the diner, and he's like, I told you I don't want to join my super secret boy band, like, and it's just, yeah, perfect delivery. I love that moment. But also, this does have one of my favorite scenes in the MCU and in Tony's story, and that's when he plays the message from Howard Stark about, you know, that the old promo of where he's talking about his designs for the future and all that, and then, you know, his old recording, and Tony's just, you know, ignoring it. Like, this is where we get the hints of, like, him exploring how he still has a lot of resentment toward his father and never had that warm relationship and all that. But then that moment where it cuts to Howard Stark, you know, talking directly and says, you know, Tony, and then he does this monologue, and it's, you know, my greatest creation is you. And I'm like, that's still, I mean, and it's perfect delivery. They got John Slattery to play him. And that really is a great payoff, you know, going back to not just like the doomsday theories and all that, but especially how it paves the way and connects back to Endgame and the scene when they get to meet each other in the past. And it's a great moment. So there's still a lot to love about this movie, even though it was for a while it was ranked toward the bottom of the MCU, but again, I think that was because there were so many others that were really, really good, you know, like, so it wasn't like, I, you know, I, ne- I also, I never, you know, strongly disliked this movie or, you know, had it on the bottom, but it was like, when you compare it with Avengers and First Captain America and stuff like that and First Iron Man, yes, this definitely was like on the lower end, but it still, you know, got a lot in there. And yeah, you know, so again, going back to Tony and Howard, so what do you think this tells us about Tony's character and how this relationship becomes integral to the MCU?
That's why I am extremely upset with current comics canon, because I'm pretty sure this hasn't been retconned, because there was a retcon of Tony not being his biological son. And there, of course, this was during Aaron's run of the Avengers, and Mephisto was involved in a bunch of stuff that made Howard even more of a villain rather than like a complicated man. Well, this movie makes him a complicated man. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we approve of everything that he does. That means that we look at him as a person, the totality of who he is. It's like, oh, there's more than I expect. If I just make a knee-jerk reaction, I'm going to hate someone without seeing who they are as a person. Because he did love Tony. He did see him as his greatest creation. But he also spent much time away from him, wasn't always the best person when it came to loving his son. Like, these two things can both be true at the same time. And I think the film did a great enough job at showing that, because, well, how do you make a man like Tony Stark? Well, you have a man, Howard Stark, who does love him, but doesn't always seem to make him the priority. Is focused more on his company and his inventions, and doesn't seem to show that same love to his wife. And, well, no wonder Tony ends up the way he does, because he's got to prove himself to his dad. In a, once again, a way much better than Ang Lee's Hulk, which I think is our punching bag for, I guess, this episode. You know, because Tony wants Daddy to love him, and it's shown here.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, just the way all that plays out. I mean, it you know, like you're saying too, yes, there were a lot of obligatory world building elements they had to do. And again, Favreau wasn't as crazy about including those, but he still, you know, does a great job of making a character driven story. And yeah, it still really holds up. And I do love the action sequences. And with the recasting, another thing, you know, you can look up like why Terrence Howard left. But I did really like Terrence Howard in the first one, but, Don Cheadle, I think, really is a Rhodey, War Machine. So, you know, it worked out. But I do love the scene when the fight scene at the end, I'm like, yes, it's big, you know, robots fighting them and stuff, but it's pretty cool. I also have to give credit for that scene, because I get kind of, there's a lot of this in the MCU where there is infinite collateral damage and, you know, you're like cheering on while, you know, like battles are taking place and citizens are getting killed. I do appreciate in the final battle in this one, there aren't really any civilian casualties. Like, there's destruction and stuff, but I like that that final fight takes place like off in the woods and they're away from people. That was refreshing, because while the collateral damage obviously plays a part and paves the way for Civil War, you know, it gets a little exhausting. And when it's not addressed, it's problematic. So I did like that takes place there. I also love Sam Rockwell as Justin Hammer. Perfect casting there. I kind of wish we got to see him again. But yeah, so there's still, I mean, yeah, it still holds up. With that in mind, now I'm really interested now, because I was not expecting, actually, knowing your taste, like, I just did not expect you to put Iron Man 2 this high. So I'm now very interested in your ranking of these three movies.
Yeah, I'll go 2-1 Hulk. One does an excellent job at introducing Tony to the regular general audience. I think 2 builds up on that even more. And Hulk is Hulk. I mean, it's not like the Marvels forgettable or Brave New World bad. Like, it is what it is.
That's really interesting, because, like, we had the same, the Fox X-Men ranking, super easy. We all were in agreement there. I'm going to go, Iron Man is easily my number one. It still remains one of my all-time favorite MCU movies, favorite comic book movies, and then Hulk, and then Iron Man 2. So, like, you know, I give them, like, you know, sort of similar ratings, those are two. Not bad by any means, but, you know, entertaining, but there's things about each I like, but I think there is a big gap between those and the first Iron Man film. So that's really interesting. But yeah.
Oh yeah.
Excellent. So, let's see. And now this is a fun, so We are talking about post-credit scenes, and there are numerous throughout, almost 40 movies now, something like that. I can give mine while you're thinking, but have, like, you can list a couple too, if you, let's kind of, like, obviously the Avengers one, is a game changer, like, that's, a given. One of my all-time favorites, though, has to be in Spider-Man Far From Home, when we had J.K. Simmons, J. Jonah Jameson return, who we'd later learn is a different version of Jameson, but still, I was so happy that they brought Simmons to play the character again, because no one else can do it like him, and it was, and that one was such a brilliant scene, because it was Mysterio posthumously reveals Peter Parker to the world as Spider-Man. I'll always remember that in the theater. So that was one of my all-time favorites. But do you have, Christian, either a favorite or a couple favorites?
I mean, it's hard. I mean, there are definitely better ones out there, but I do remember the initial first one the most because of how I felt. Oh, once again, they're going to be making more with some of these characters I love. That's great. Then, of course, the Avengers one, where I was like, okay, yeah, Loki is our main villain. You know, it makes sense. He's why they become the Avengers in Avengers 1, all the way back to the end. But then we get to Thanos, and my little geeky heart just, like, exploded from happiness. As someone who has read through Infinity Gauntlet, like, multiple times over before that movie had even come out, I was like, yes, I want to see him on screen. Does that mean we're doing cosmic stuff and, like, not knowing all the rights issues? Could we get Silver Surfer, Adam Warlock, and all this? And obviously that's not what happened, but, like, the speculation that came just from seeing him on screen, it's like, yes, give me more of that. So I'm gonna say Thanos' reveal.
It was a mouth drop. I mean, you're already go through, we'll get to Avengers very soon, but you already go through this epic crossover movie. We didn't need anything. You could have just said, cut to the credits, we're good. But then they dropped that. And yeah, it was just, nerd heaven. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Christian, this was an absolute blast. And before we go, do you have any recommendations either from anything we talked about tonight or something totally different? I'll give mine real quick, and that's the 90s Hulk animated series. Also pretty short-lived, not, as iconic as Spider-Man X-Men. Right, but it's, if you've never seen that, I remember, loving that as a kid. I've rewatched it since, and it really holds up. It's so definitely check that out. You also have Mark Hamill playing, he played the leader, I think? Yeah.
He was either him or the Gargoyle. I think it was the Gargoyle.
Yeah, you're right. But yeah, I was like, awesome.
So in the comics, there's been all this news about, like, the Armageddon stuff or whatever they're doing with Marvel, whether or not that's going to be, like, a total reboot or not. Odds are probably not, but that got me thinking. It's been a while. I hadn't read Crisis on Infinite Earths again, so I did that again, and it definitely holds up. DC is a giant muddled mess, just as much as Marvel's a giant muddled mess, but they have more time to get muddled up. And Crisis at the time was the perfect way of, like, getting things back on track, of, like, establishing things before they would eventually go New 52, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, Crisis on Infinite Earths.
It's the perfect blueprint if you ever want to reset your universe. That's kind of how you do it. And yeah, fun fact, I got to interview Marv Wolfman years ago at a con, so that was a blast.
Nice.
Yeah, that was a lot. Yeah, that was a cool moment. Awesome. Well, Christian, thank you so much as always. And we've got many more episodes in this series to go. So thank you all for listening, watching. We'll be talking about all the movies leading up to Doomsday later this year. So stick with us. And remember, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests. Take care.
Hello there, listener. This is Evan Garcia, and I just wanted to jump in here to remind you and to let you know of our Facebook groups and our Discord server. These are great communities where you can post and share memes and talk with the hosts, and we have votes and some polls for future episode topics and fun interactions with our hosts. So just wanted to remind you that we are focused on community with you listeners, and we love each and every one of you guys listening. Thank you, guys.
This show is a proud member of the Anazal Podcast Network. Other shows on the network include Be Living Water, where Joshua Knoll discusses various topics from a Taoist Christian perspective. inviting listeners to imitate Christ and be water, beneficial to all, and a conflict with none. Friday Night Frights, Day and Christian Ashley discuss all things frightful, from UFOs to the paranormal to serial killers and more. Kung Fu Pizza Party, where Brandon discusses all things martial arts media, delivering high-flying action and wisdom, one slice at a time, all in under 30 minutes. And my other show, with Christy Whaley, Theology on the Rocks, where two theology PhDs talk about our lives, the world, and theology, all over drinks, clearly. Come on over each week to hear two besties discuss academic nerd stuff while also banter endlessly, especially if wine is involved.